Hello and welcome to Unfrozen. My name is Dan Safarik.
And as always, I'm his co-host, Greg Lindsay. Although not always, Dan, I'm sorry I missed our last episode, but we have a great guest coming in for this one that I'm very pleased to have a chance to speak to. Who's joining us this week on Unfrozen?
This is Richard Francis Jones. He is the principal of FJMT Studio in Australia and the author of Truth and Lies in Architecture, which is what we're interested in talking to him about today.
The best title. I simply love that. I cannot wait till we get to the lies portion. Are you looking more forward to the truth or the lies? I know I'm looking forward to the lies.
I want to hear the true lies, actually.
Please welcome Richard Francis Jones. Richard, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Well, great to be with you both and looking forward to talking to you.
So fundamentally, I'm interested in why you were interested in creating a book like this, which is not really a manifesto, but it is very philosophical and not in the traditional architectural sense. What inspired you?
Well, thank you, Daniel, for that question, observation about the book. Look, it's an interesting story, which is a bit personal in a way. I think the book is constructed as a series of essays which kind of sit together. Each one of them is about 1,500 to 2,000 words. So something I think people can read in a short amount of time. And some of these things I've been thinking about, of course, most of them for almost my entire professional life. I have written a few essays before. But what prompted me to write this book was actually the COVID-19 crisis we all went through and the enormous stress it put on us. And in fact, it was a sort of way of managing the stress that I started to write most of this book. I kind of went into a slightly more sort of rarefied atmosphere of observation on our profession, on our industry, and our culture, and really just got on a roll writing these things. So it was a way of kind of staying healthy, I guess, through what has been a pretty trying time.
Remarkable. I mean, and it's also just, you know, most of the think pieces that were written during that period of time was kind of on the, tip of, well, let's figure out when we're going to get back to normal and things will get normal soon, right? And not too many people took a break to really think about things. So I think that was, I commend you for that. So here's a question, you know, we live in what some people call a post-truth era. What do you think architecture has to say to that? And how is the passage into a post-truth era, if you will, affected the practice of architecture?
Oh, look, thank you. And that thank you for that question. One of the essays is Truth and Lies, the truth of architecture and the lies of the architect. And partly it was a reaction to exactly that post-truth era that you talk about, the fact that we seem to live in times when truth is actually determined by the number of hits you get on Instagram or chat site, or the amount of popularity you have, or the number of times you just repeat it, rather than on what we might think of as evidence or objective fact. And I think this has been a deeply disorientating time for us all. And for architecture, where I think that's interesting is that architecture has always had this slightly strained relationship to truth. You know, we've had various architects and theoreticians making statements about the truth of architecture, truth to materials from the modernist era, for example, and a rejection of ornament and so on in the modern era. And also we see various ideologies adopting architecture as their representation, whether that's, you know, going back into classical times, or indeed whether it's actually the adoption of a kind of stripped down classical architecture for a representation of fascism in the war period, immediate war period, or whether it's the adoption of classicism to represent the ideals of democracy, as we see in Washington. And so architecture's had this sort of ambivalent and ambiguous relationship to truth. And that was one of the things that I was very interested in exploring. How does architecture actually tell truths? Is that, in fact, possible? Or is architecture always transparent to truth, and it can be adopted by whatever ideology chooses to adopt it?
I'm sure you saw the news come out, which was very quickly recanted once the Biden administration came into play here in the U.S. But the proclamation by Trump that all architecture for federal buildings was to be in the classical style, that must have been banging around in your head.
Yeah, and look, I have to say that that essay was also prompted by the success of Donald Trump. There's this big image of him in the book as part of that essay. So yes, that certainly has had an effect. You know, the other way in which we can think about truth as architects and designers, if we just look at it in a very pragmatic way, that we think about the beauty of natural materials, the depth of natural materials, and in a way our connection to them as human beings that have been working in wood and stone and metal and indeed glass for centuries. But we've now come to a moment in our history where it's actually very difficult to tell what is one of these materials, that you can look at a piece of porcelain tile and it appears and almost feels exactly like a piece of Carrara marble, for example. I mean, it's almost got very difficult for even architects to tell the difference. So this also places us in this strange zone of not knowing the truth of what we work with.
Yeah, I mean, the whole idea of the honesty of materials seems to have sort of gone out the window as we've gotten more into synthetics and representation. Interesting that it should be at a time, though, when we're rediscovering things like biophilia and, you know, mass timber, of course, is the new rage now, particularly in my line of work, which is tall buildings. And I'm wondering what your thoughts might be on that.
Oh, look, I think that's true. There is a lot of very positive signs, I think, in our desire to get more connected to the natural world, I think, and realize that we have been alienated through this modern period, and our architecture has been central to that sense of disconnection and alienation from the natural world. And a return to that is fundamental, I think, to addressing some of the key challenges that we face. Part of that, of course, is the responsibility of architecture. And as you identify, there are some really positive signs in that we are thinking about architecture. We're thinking about place in ways which I think are deeper and more connected with the natural world. And, you know, the use of timber, our understanding of biophilia and a kind of broader, more holistic approach to architecture and human existence. But at the same time, of course, this is happening at a moment when we are indeed fundamentally alienated from these processes, and that we are in fact living in much more abstract worlds, digital worlds almost. Our very identity, in fact, becomes more concerned with a digital presence than a reality. And also, architecture itself now is literally consumed as an image. So these movements, in fact, are fighting against each other in many ways.
I would love, Richard, to return to this notion of the imagery. I would say, now that Dan and I are thinking about it, we've riffed in past episodes on the metaverse, but I've yet to see, and part of me thinks it's going to be Zaha Hadid Architects that's out there first, you know, to really establish a metaversal practice for some of these Web3 startups. But going back to the natural elements and getting into some of perhaps the lies here of this, this is a bit orthogonal in a way, but I was in the Pacific Northwest this past week speaking to a group of experts of tires, and there was a whole presentation about, you know, how do they make tires more sustainable? There's investments in circular economies and devulcanization of rubber, et cetera. But there became a whole larger discussion about, you know, the need for sustainability to achieve net zero will require basically strip mining the world. You know, the World Bank estimates a 500% increase in mining of rare earths and other things. And this gets back to, you know, many ways of the practice of architecture, this notion of, you know, whether it's mass timber or something else, you know, isn't there sort of an intrinsic lie the profession tells itself about, you know, that it's natural and these natural elements, while it is still, of course, building. And I'm curious about like how you see the sort of the profession sort of resolving these essential tensions about the fact that it is an entire industry geared to build that must grapple with this existential period that maybe it shouldn't be building or should be rethinking this. I mean, obviously the Lakatom and Vassil Pritzker is sort of speaking to that too, of retrofits and never building new, et cetera, et cetera. I think there's a question there somewhere if you can pick it out.
Yeah, no, Greg, I think it's a good question. And I actually begin this series of essays with a piece about melancholy, actually. And I talk about melancholy as a artistic kind of motivator or insight, but also a melancholy that comes from exactly the point that you have made, that we're almost overwhelmed at the challenges that are in front of us as architects. And in a way, we can see ourselves actually as part of the problem rather than part of the solution. If we're going to continue to just build a whole series of new buildings, if we're going to continue to strip down existing buildings and build new ones, you know, the enormous carbon cost, environmental cost of doing all of that, and we may dress it up in words and images that make it appear responsible and indeed potentially green, but really, what are we doing? You know, if we step back for a moment, are we doing the right thing? So it is a very poignant question, I think, and one that we do need to ask. Of course, the notion that we should adapt the existing building stock is one that is hard to argue with. But at the same time, you know, I think one of the things we can neglect in our very valid concern for sustainability and addressing carbon and climate change is that we can make the mistake of only dealing with it in very empirical ways, very measurable ways, and that trying to analyze it and put targets together and put rating systems together, these are all really important. And of course, they vary and several have faults and gaps and so on. But it's actually not enough. And what I try to argue in this book is that architecture has a much deeper purpose. It's not to say that, of course, we need to go to net zero carbon. We must address these issues. But as architects, the responsibility of architecture is a little bit greater. I think architecture and the experience of architecture is one that needs to make us closer to nature, that actually needs to try and reestablish a connection that we have lost to the natural world. And it's worth reflecting on one of the most important things that we can do as architects for sustainability is actually to build buildings which are valued, buildings which are actually loved by their community, because these buildings will last forever. They will be sustained, they will be adapted, and their longevity will be assured. And that is a very important quality of their sustainability, but it's one based on building buildings for which the community has an extraordinary empathy, which go a little bit more to our hearts, if I can put it that way.
And I think there's also something to be said about, and very, very good point, by the way. I mean, I think there's something also to be said about the way that we kind of valorize, an accumulation of systems or an accumulation of, you know, environmental product declarations about how sustainable something is being constructed when, you know, what if it replaces a building that's, you know, 25 or 30 years old? It's like, have we given that prior building a fair shake, or was there something fundamental that didn't speak to people about that prior building? Or is it just the wastefulness of the development community overall that's leading to the demolition in favor of what ostensibly may be a more sustainable building? But it's kind of like, one almost thinks like architects should take something like a Hippocratic oath, right? Like, first do no harm, but build a building that is unlikely to be torn down, and that's the best thing you can do.
Look, I really like that, Daniel. I think a Hippocratic oath for architects is a great thing. And first of all, do no more harm would be a good way to begin it.
But of course, we don't want to put ourselves out of work either.
Well, this is a bit of a slippery slope, gentlemen, too, isn't it? I mean, Sean and Williams, you know, who've had multiple buildings, you know, torn down recently after what? I mean, after only a few decades, I can't imagine they ever thought they were doing harm to it. And I think their buildings were critically lauded. Richard, I want to expand upon it because the phrase has been ringing in my head since the beginning of this. I believe it was Keats, right? You know, in beauty there's truth, truth beauty, and you finally made the statement there about, or in a way about loving a building. I find that interesting in terms of like under what criteria do we argue for love in this context? Because when you know on Twitter, for example, when there's accounts devoted to traditional architecture, it raises dog whistles. You know, the trad saying that there's eternal principles of beauty that gets back to the neoclassicism. And, you know, it drives the modernists nuts, you know, in the sense of trying to argue this position of absolute truth from classical, which you've already sort of debunked already. So I guess my question is, like, what criteria do we use here? Because in a way, I keep thinking about people like, I don't know, like, you know, pure formalists who would argue that the core of architecture is the form versus the larger societal programmatic elements, which is personally where my sympathies more lie. But yeah, how do we define love? And who has to love it, I guess, under that criteria? Does it have to be just the community, given what we know of like poisonous American community board meetings, or does it have to be the critical architecture community, or like whose love are we measuring? I guess.
I'll look at a lot of questions in that one, Greg. Thank you. I think first of all, there's this question of whether architecture is separate from all of these things, has a degree of autonomy, if you like. And I think one of the architects we might think of like that is perhaps Aldo Rossi, whose work kind of pursued that idea and was very kind of classically based. And I think if we are looking for an architecture that could in any way be autonomous, then maybe classicism is exactly that. It's been around for thousands of years. Maybe at this point it is sort of stripped bare and washed of all of the ideologies, contradictory as they might be, that have been placed on it. But I would say no. I would say it still has those associations, and in the country where I live in Australia, and of course also in North America, we have this issue of reconciliation and resolution with our First Nations cultures, and classicism surely to those cultures can't represent anything other than a source of oppression. So I don't think architecture is ever neutral, is ever, shall I say, innocent. It is always connected with the events that have taken place within it, that it has been shaped by. And I think there is this mutual kind of interconnection between architecture and the events around it. At a certain point, you know, it's not the case with a freshly minted building, perhaps, but we can't separate these sites for events from the events themselves, whether they're significant or insignificant. And this is why I think when it comes to existing building stock, you know, we do need to look closely at it. It is easy to just run over the value of an existing building without forgetting actually that does embody and associate a whole lot of memories for people. Is there a way to keep it? Is there a way to have a continuity? And in this respect, we are, of course, always struggling with this modernist idea to make new, an obsession with something that is fresh and new. And of course, all of the social media that might promote an interest in the current, you know, in the next, in the most fashionable. And it's not a new thing. This has been going on for centuries, of course, this obsession and beguile with something that is new and different and contradictory. But coming back to the question of love, and perhaps we should think more in terms of meaning, I think, perhaps, than love. The point I'm making there is that architecture has the potential for a very extended life. And in many ways, architecture represents a human desire for immortality. You know, as architects, we often talk about our work or our objective being a timelessness. You know, it's a very common thing you will hear architects say, this is a very timeless project. This is one that is going to extend its life and indeed extend our lives. And this is a very kind of fraught and sensitive responsibility for architecture. How is it to really live up to that expectation? How is architecture to defeat time? How is it to have that longevity? And in the book, I do talk about four ways in which architecture can do that.
Well, we should probably articulate them for those who haven't yet had the benefit of reading the book. Could you summarize?
Yeah, I could. So you know, I think first of all, there is a sense in which architecture tries to stand forever and have a neutral quality to itself. And potentially, this is very classically based. The building that I use an example of that is the Seagram Building in New York, that it's a kind of absolute resistance to time. You know, this is an architecture which stands still and seems completely immune to the passing of time. The other is where you actually look to embrace the passing of time. In a sense, you accept it. You create an architecture which is very kind of transient and ephemeral, that in fact weathers immediately it is completed. And perhaps the process of nature reclaiming the architecture is part of the architecture itself. It's a very light architecture. And an example I give of that actually is the work of an Australian architect, Richard Lepastria. And then another one is one of kind of challenge. You know, I think it's almost like a headlong rush to the void. You know, it's the avant-garde. It's the rejection of the past and a headlong run at the future. And finally, I think it's one where architecture seeks to be a transformation, that architecture is not built as a complete building, that it is built as a moment, and that is an architecture which is open to adaptation and transformation, that it's not something that is finished. And that is perhaps a more difficult thing for architects to grasp. It's in a sense the ability to make also an architecture that reaches these kind of two senses of being ancient and being modern, of being something that grounds us, but also something that projects us forward simultaneously.
Speaking of being projected forward and towering ambitions, I would be remiss if I did not bring up the elephantitis in the room, which is the chapter called The Fall of the Architect, which posits very eloquently that it is a desire both for this sort of immortality, the triumph of the ego, and also something bordering on a death wish that makes us want to build tall and want to tiptoe toward the edge of whatever tall structure we find ourselves upon, and perhaps to create them as well. I thought that was just a really stunning passage, and it was a perspective, believe me, in my business, you know, at the Council on Tall Buildings and Urban Habitat, we have seen, I thought, every perspective on why we build high, but I had not yet heard that one. So I'd love to hear a little bit more about that.
Oh, thank you, Daniel. And I thought you might bring up this essay, actually, but I was a bit worried about it because, of course, yes, it is indeed a provoking piece on the nature of the tall building. And I think it's really fascinating. You know, we have to acknowledge that we seem to have an obsession with building tall. We have for thousands of years seen this as almost an instinctive human quality, that we want to build tall. And why is that? And that's the question I ask in this essay. Why is that? Is it because we want to defend ourselves? I mean, we all know high ground is a good place to defend. Is it because we want the sense of separation and the vista that it brings? What is it? Is it indeed because we wanted to be closer to God? Is it really a kind of escape from the difficulties and the challenges of being on this earth, of being stuck down here, and we want to get into a more rarefied, purer, or indeed more spiritual space? These are you know, natural instincts in a sense, and we can understand them. And later, another essay in here, actually, where I talk about that is where I also use the example of the Tower of Babel, one of our most important early towers, about 4,000 years ago, we built that one, ultimately ended in failure. And, you know, ended in failure because God struck us down and made us babble and took away our singular language that stopped us being able to cooperate with each other and build this incredible tower. And arguably, of course, globalization and the techno-scientific language of modernity solved that problem. We're all speaking the same language again, and we have built these incredible towers over this period. We've continued this obsession on almost a new scale. And I suppose the thing I introduced, which you also alluded to, was this quality that sometimes we experience of the call of the void, the tendency when you're in a high place to be drawn to the edge. And I think any of us who've stood on the scaffold building one of these tall buildings, perhaps, there is a sense of invitation and an allure to the edge, that we move towards the edge. We're attracted by this void and almost feel a sense of almost a compulsion to step out into it. And it is an understood psychological syndrome, high place syndrome, that apparently I think it is 40% of us, or close to half of us, suffer from. And so I posit this as a sort of counter to that desire, that what is it that is behind this compulsion? Why do we experience that? What is it that's pushing us to the edge of the void? And what I would like to suggest is that perhaps in a metaphorical way, that it is when it's the experience of the architect standing on top of one of these structures, it's a kind of invitation to connect ourselves to the ground more, a kind of inner psychological reminder to us that in fact these tall towers are not going to reach heaven, and then in fact the only way that we will find something that resembles a heaven on earth is to connect our work more deeply with the ground itself, with its culture, with its natural world, and indeed to make a more kind of sustaining and symbiotic presence in the world.
Forgive the passage of the elevated train behind me as I let that resonate. I'm very authentically in Chicago here. I'm about a block away from the elevated.
Lucky you.
Yeah.
You've got some beautiful tall buildings in Chicago, that's for sure.
Indeed we do. But, you know, as an architect of tall buildings, and some very nice ones, by the way, the EY Center certainly comes to mind. You know, a lovely building with the wooden shutters and the closed cavity system and the way that it stands on the site on a sort of ballet pirouette of crossed diagonals. It's pretty elegant. I'm just wondering, you know, are you able to bring this kind of thinking forward when you talk to clients, when you are pitching the design for a building? Because that doesn't seem like something that the average corporate client would want to get their heads around.
No, you're quite right. These are not really conversations for our clients. And in an early part of this book, I do talk about the great struggle that we have as architects. And what I suggest, in fact, is that theory, if we think about some of the things we've been talking about as architectural theory, is not really intended to help the architect with this practice. It's not meant to help us with architectural practice. In many ways, it's a hindrance to have these burdens, if I can put it that way. But the important thing about theory is that it does offer us these insights, and the way in which we can integrate these into our work, I believe, is through intuition. And it's being in touch with our intuitive processes, this sense of flow that many creatives talk about. that I think this is the way that we will actually be able to address these issues. And when you bring up the EY Center, you know, what was interesting about that project was we really tried to think about a different way of conceptualizing a tower in the city. We tried to think, is it possible for a tower to actually grow out of its site? You know, is it possible for a tower to not sit heavily on its site, not to sort of expunge and flatten the character, history, and culture of the city as a result of it, of its presence? And we challenged ourselves to do that. And a very important part of that building actually is the archaeological investigation that went on the site, the interpretation of the original contours of the city that went down to the tank stream and the edge of the harbour in Sydney, that is interpreted through folded granite surfaces that bring you down to a lower level. And remarkably on that project, the sandstone that the core of the building is clad in is the very sandstone that was quarried out of that site. The part of the construction process involved quarrying the very sandstone that the building was sat on. So in a sense, the building almost literally is made out of the material of the site. And I never thought that would be possible to do in my professional life, actually. So it is interesting, I think. And I feel like, EY and the developer involved in the project actually got on to all of this, that they believed in it. And I think when you're in a global company like EY, and let's say you're from Chicago and you get a posting into Sydney for a few months or a year or so, you would actually rather be in a building that was unique to its place and that helped you over the months that you were there understand the culture and character of that site, rather than one that had been simply imported from your own city, for example. So I do think it is, you do get engagement at that level, but perhaps not at the more critical, theoretical, and poetic level that we were talking about a moment ago.
And then when you look back at some of the other projects that perhaps took a more conventional shape, do you feel regret about that you weren't able to bring them to the same level as something like an EY Center with an enlightened client? How do you feel about those projects in relation to some of the ideas that you've put forward in this book?
Oh, I think there's always going to be more and less opportunity in a particular project. And you're always going to bring maybe more awareness to one project than another. I don't think any architect's work is at a consistent level. I think what is important is to try and find an opportunity in every project, which is what we try to find. And I think, look, not every project can hit those aspirations, but of course we should keep trying. And I think one of the great things about being an architect is that projects are not isolated. They tend to build on each other, that we can learn a lot from one project to the next. And then also the other thing I would say is that, you know, when I sat back and wrote this book, I tried to write it apart from my own work. I tried to think more broadly about the challenges we face as a profession, of course, bringing my professional experience into it, but also not being limited by it.
Yeah, that's one thing that I would definitely want to put forward for readers when I was trying to sort of grasp what it was that was sort of different about this book, was that it wasn't like a traditional architecture manifesto, and it wasn't like a traditional crestomathy of, you know, one's own work. In fact, I think you might have two or three of your own projects scattered through in here, and mentioning just a very few other architects' projects, at least in the contemporary realm, which I thought is quite interesting. And then you have the imagery that you've chosen. There's lots of fine art. There's quite a bit from movies. And I don't know whether you chose the cover or not, but that's quite interesting. It's a scene from the movie Ex Machina. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, I can, yeah. And yes, I worked very closely on the selection of those images. And they do draw from film and art as much as architecture. And while there are a few images of my own projects in there, they're not really referred to in the work. They're not really the subject of the point that I'm making. And the Ex Machina image, is a it's a beautiful image from the film. And I use that in a in an essay that's called The Consciousness of the Architect. And really this is quite an interesting concept to pursue, really, is consciousness. And hence the image of the android robotic figure in Ex Machina. And indeed, one of the great challenges in that film and some others is this question of consciousness, where what are the limits of consciousness? And architects work in that space a lot. I quote Louis Kahn there, and Louis Kahn, spoke about architectural materials almost as if they were conscious. He would say, "What does a brick want to be? What is the nature of this? What is it in this material, or indeed in this form? What is its desire or its consciousness?" And what I suggest in this essay is that we have a bit of a moment in science at the moment where consciousness perhaps isn't fully understood by any means, and these questions are being asked by both by scientists and both by philosophers. David Chalmers, an Australian philosopher, is one who asks this question, the so-called hard question of human consciousness. Where are its limits? And I think if we can imagine, if we can perhaps think that consciousness goes far beyond a human or indeed animal sentience, if it is something that we can extend more broadly into the world, if we can think of our natural world as having consciousness, then I think it can actually help us as architects and help us understand the real opportunity we have for a symbiotic relationship with the world around us. And it is perhaps a conceptual leap, but interestingly enough, not that hard to make. We do regularly imbue things around us with life. And of course, if you're around children, they almost do it instinctively. They give life to everything around them. And yet in the process of becoming an adult, we seem to extinguish that life. And as a result, treat our world and those around us and the life around us in a much more instrumental way. I think, in some ways, if we could recover a perception of the world that we have as children, we might actually solve a lot of the great challenges we face with that view.
Richard, since you invoke children in that, which of course makes me think of education, I want to sort of echo Dan's earlier question there about how do you bring this philosophy to the client and take it back towards architectural education, which of course is something I haven't had. Dan's the one who went to architecture school, but I've encountered it, of course, in meeting, of course, and lectures at GSD at Harvard and, of course, GSAP at Columbia, many other institutions. And these are not conversations that I have had there. And so I'm curious your thoughts on, how to bring this philosophical approach back into architectural education and where you would start.
Greg, yeah, it's a good question. I think it is a debate that we should be having in our architectural schools, I feel. And look, I do a bit of teaching. I have done for many, many years, pretty much since I graduated. And of course, in the studio, it's possible to talk about architecture in this way. And I think it's quite important that we try to bring these kind of perspectives to the student experience. And I guess I should say that that has been partly my intention in writing this book, is someone who had read it spoke to me actually just last week, and were saying that they felt it would be the kind of book that students would actually enjoy and find perhaps in some respects challenging, but in other ways helpful. You know, one of the things, if I can just mention something in relation to education that I mention in this book, is that I talk about the character of the architect, you know, the character of the people we produce as architects, and the slight duality in that, you know, architects are by necessity optimistic, that they are in fact pushing visions and possibilities for the future, and the force with which they can do that in a very optimistic and positive way is vital to their ability to persuade others. But at the same time, you know, it's architects on the flip side of that coin can actually be very negative. And I think as a profession, we're at risk of breeding a kind of negative culture through some of the most basic structures of our education. And the example I give is actually the jury critique that generally follows every project's preparation. It's the kind of final thing where you present to a jury. And these are more often than not very negative, that it seems that the task of the jurors is to find the weakness, to criticize the project. And this, of course, requires the student to be resilient, to push their point of view, to bounce back, and so on. And my concern is that we breed a culture of negative critique, which I believe is the absolute opposite of what we should be doing. That I think often the purpose here is to find the magic in the project, to find the hidden strength that it has, to reveal that to the student. And I reflect how many students of architecture have actually left architecture as a result of these harsh critiques. How much talent have we actually lost? And this negativity, I think, also cannot serve us well in the culture of our profession. And I think it's a sort of flip side of the enormous positivity and energy we have to put into our work, but one that we have to be cautious of, that we need to, in my view at least, mediate better.
Indeed, and then to see this in the context of, you know, some of the recent outrages that have happened around architectural education, you know, such as the SciArc situation, where a group of administrators of SciArc who were also professionals were kind of handing it down to the kids, saying, "Well, this is how I had it, and it was terrible for me, and it will be terrible for you, and you're going to like it, and you're going to accept it." And they got a lot of blowback, and I think justly so. You know, if we don't approach the gigantic problems to which we are, you know, unwitting contributors, if we're not working against, then we're going to have a very difficult time overcoming these problems.
I think that's right. You will not be graduating architects with what I think is the most important quality they need to have, and that's the ability to listen. That you will be kind of brutalizing them through this. And it's almost as if, and you know, it's interesting to hear that story, you know, because it's almost like this paradigm of the kind of Howard Roark, you know, the architect is the sort of singular possessor of truth, the one who knows and the one that does not need to listen and that can push through an outcome. And I think surely, you know, that era has gone. You know, the era of the modern masters, I think, needs to be well put behind us if we're going to really address the most important challenges culturally and environmentally that we face.
Indeed, I can just keep flashing back to an architecture critique that I had when I was at school. And, you know, I had a building that had a bunch of, you know, porthole windows in it and some circular elements. And the reviewer said, "You know, I just don't buy circles in buildings." And I said, "Oh yes, you're right. Silly me. You know, the Pantheon. What a dump." How do you react to that if someone's coming at you with such negativity. It's like, how long did it take you to think to say that? And that's your critique of work. And it's, I mean, that is the kind of culture that still sort of permeates in a lot of schools of architecture.
I think it is. And it's a culture that we'd be better off without, I think. And, you know, the education of the architect is such an important thing. And these architects that we produce are going to continue their presence in our profession. And I think we need to build a much greater sense of support and camaraderie and sensitivity and openness in our profession. And it will be, you know, it'll be, if we can do that, it would be extraordinary to think of the kind of architects that we would produce.
Well, to the extent that I have any power at all, I'm going to say that Truth and Lies in Architecture should be required reading. But I really want to thank you, Richard, for your time.
Oh, thank you, Daniel, and also Greg. It's really been a great pleasure talking to you both. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Truth and Lies in Architecture, Richard Francis Jones.